Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the Santa Fe Metaphysical Film Festival. Right now, I would like to welcome playwright and director Cynthia Ruffin. Her new play is called God Ain't Done With Me Yet. And Yolanda Briscoe, who is executive director and clinical director of the Santa Fe Recovery Center. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Good to have you. Now, this is all about Substance Dependence Recovery Week. Mm-hmm. And you, Cynthia, were commissioned to write a play about people who are substance abusers.
I met Yolanda probably in November of last year, and I was commissioned to do a play that dealt with what it looks like to go through a 28-day recovery program that is recovering from alcohol and drug abuse.
Yeah. And so it's an interesting thing to have to do that without being too didactic.
Mm-hmm. I mean the play definitely has a dark side to it. You know, so quite literally, the first half of it is called The Darkness, the second half is called The Light. And there's music that runs through the entire piece as well. There's a radio announcer
right. That's
on stage. It kind of acts a little bit as a...
Who
a
says, good morning, morning, Santa Fe, at the beginning.
Good morning, Santa Fe, exactly. That kind of acts as a Greek chorus. And that radio announcer also plays music that reflects the darkness in the first half of the play. And then the second half of the play, it lightens up. And we really get a sense of hope as we get towards the end of it.
One of the things that I learned in the play was that New Mexico has the... Is this right, Yolanda? The highest rate of drug-related deaths in the United States?
Yes, it is true. Yes, it is true.
How'd we get that way?
It wasn't easy. So we're trying to do our part through recovery. You know, with every dollar that we spend on recovery and treatment, you save about $13 to $15 in incarcerations and crime-related side effects of being an addict. So it's really, if you had to decide where should I spend my money, would be in treatment, but unfortunately it's not like that. There's more money spent in incarceration and punishment, and we all know that punishment just doesn't work.
Right. Now, I mean, it's not only an economic issue, but it's just a humanistic issue. Helping people recover allows them to lead fulfilled lives. Incarceration really pretty much doesn't.
Exactly. And not only do you help the addict, but you help the whole family and then society in general.
So what is the situation for people who are seeking treatment in the state of New Mexico?
Well, there are quite a few outpatient treatment facilities and a few residential treatment facilities. A residential treatment facility is the most restrictive. It's for somebody who has really tried all other different avenues of trying to become clean and hasn't been able to achieve that sobriety. So we have 23 beds for individuals in northern New Mexico for individuals who are seeking treatment, who have tried everything else and haven't been successful.
If you could wave a magic wand, would you have twice as many beds or 100 times? I mean, what's the demand compared to what you've got available?
We would definitely have more beds, but we would have maybe a gender-specific treatment for just women and children. I lived in San Francisco and ran a treatment facility in San Francisco, and it was for women and their children up to the age of 12. And it was long-term, and so you could really do a lot with the family. Versus short-term where it's a taste of recovery, but doing a long-term, a year, 18-month with women and their children is something that we would hope to do, and also transitional living. So we're doing these fundraising activities to expand not so much more beds, but expand what we do to meet different populations.
This is actually something that comes up in the play, Cynthia Ruffin, where men and women are separated into different recovery groups because they heal differently.
Mm-hmm.
What's that all about?
Well, it's so interesting. I'm not in recovery myself, so I was invited to go into the recovery center and actually be able to speak with the residents of the center and attend groups. I didn't attend any family counseling groups or anything like that, but the larger groups, I was actually able to go in and sit in on the groups. And what I found was remarkable, and that was the reason why I thought it was so important to include that there is a men's group and a women's group, is that men and women not only heal differently, but they talk about their issues differently, and they feel comfortable talking about different sets of issues differently. There isn't the whole idea that I'll be judged for this or for that. Men kind of have a different type of camaraderie than women do. So just by virtue of that, this makes a whole different healing process, a whole different way of walking through your path to recovery, basically.
Without breaking any confidences, obviously, but what are some examples of how men and women deal with this differently?
Well, for women, you have issues around body, self-image. By and large, a lot of abuse, histories of abuse. And so if you were talking about things about your past having to do with abuse and you're in a group with men, it would be more difficult because that's the perpetrator and the victim. And so they're going to have different issues come up for them. Also, children, childcare, if you want to go into treatment, but who's going to take care of your kids? So we do have gender-specific groups, but as far as a gender only, male or female, we don't have that at this time.
Can I add something about that? The interesting thing, too, is that even though there's a men's and a women's group, one of the things that I found when I sat in groups, and I included in the play as well, is that one of the female characters talks about having experienced being sexually molested, and that led to a recurring cycle in her life that included sexual molestation and acting out sexually. And she talks about in her group how she wouldn't be able to say that in a group where there are men in the group because the men just wouldn't understand. Where at the same time in the men's group, a man is disclosing that he has a history of being molested and how that has led him in his drug issue, his challenges with drugs, and how it's become a recurring issue in his life. So whereas some of the things that the challenges that these individuals might face could be really, really similar to each other, it would have a hard time coming up in a group where they had to actually be in the same group with each other.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So how did you come up with the characters? Is it seven different characters?
Seven different characters, including the radio announcer, who is
right.
A radio announcer who is also in recovery. And it was hard. Basically, I really just wanted to try and get a real large cross-section of the variety of people who are affected by drug and alcohol abuse. And it's everybody. I think a lot of people jump to really specific assumptions about who drug users are, who drug abusers are, the people who are affected with the disease of alcoholism. We make assumptions about who we think these people are. And then
sort of class status, social strata. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it makes people, I believe, afraid to engage. They say, well, it's not really my problem. It's not really a problem that exists in my community. But in actuality, it's a problem that goes right across all communities, socioeconomic level, race, religious background, religious beliefs. Drug and alcohol abuse and dependency just goes right across the board and affects us all, really.
We're talking to Cynthia Ruffin and Yolanda Briscoe about the play God Ain't Done With Me Yet, which is part of Substance Dependence Recovery Week. And by the way, it is going to be performed at the James A. Little Theater on Friday and Saturday at 7 o'clock, the 19th and 20th, this weekend, and Sunday afternoon at 2 in the, at 2 in the afternoon. Excuse me. One of the things that comes up in the play is the not only things that people know about, for example, like alcohol and Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, but also codependency. What is codependency and how does it fit into the drug and alcohol substance problem?
Well, with the codependency, what we try to address is not just the individual, but the entire family or the family system, whatever that family looks like. And are they assisting in the recovery? Or are they actually assisting in encouraging the addiction because maybe they are too afraid for the person to not be an addict because then they might not be needed anymore? And so we try to address all those different issues. We
Is
provide
that
family.
Right?
Yes.
That's scary.
Like, why would somebody want somebody to keep using drugs? Well, it's not a conscious, like, you know, here, continue to use drugs so that you can ruin your life, but then you won't need me anymore. That's one of the fears of individuals who come into treatment. What's going to happen when I'm not using anymore, and how are people going to relate to me? and somebody who was used to being the caretaker and was used to being there for the addict, and suddenly that role has changed, can be very frightening.
The role of spirituality is a theme throughout the play, and in fact, it's in the title, God Ain't Done With Me Yet. Is it, and this is something maybe more of a question for you, Yolanda, but we'll talk about it in the context of the play as well, is it necessary to have a kind of spiritual focus in order to recover from substance abuse?
Well, we don't insist that the person call their higher power God. It can be whatever the individual chooses to look at as their higher power. We certainly encourage the 12-step model, which is having a higher power. I myself am not in recovery, and the reason that I say, yeah, let's do the 12-step program, and I bought into it, is because that's what the literature says works.
What if you're a hardcore atheist?
We can still work with you. We've had a few. And some kind of a higher power, something that takes you outside of yourself and the selfishness and looking at just yourself, something to get out of you, and it's very healing.
So what did you draw on, Cynthia, in writing this play, God Ain't Done With Me Yet, in terms of the spiritual stuff? Do you have your own background that helped you with it? That helped you write these characters?
Well, I do. I mean, I certainly have very spiritual beliefs. I'm not religious per se at all, not at all. And it's interesting because I do know people who have said, you know, I've shied away from 12-step programs because the God thing, I just couldn't get with it. And as I, and then I had my own battle when I was writing the piece, that I didn't want it to become a God-centered and God-focused piece. I didn't want it to seem like it was embracing any one tradition. The more and more I talk to people who are in recovery, the more and more I learned that the idea of having some type of greater power outside of yourself that you could seriously put your faith into. I mean, a lot of the time, talking with people who are in recovery and doing research for the piece, I mean, a lot of what I was learning is that individuals would go in saying, well, I can do this. I can do this on my own. And I can make a change in my life. And really, what I was finding is that the people who had decided to just have faith, to really have faith, and that really turned into having a faith in a power greater than yourself, that there is a power greater than yourself that makes the trees grow and makes everything as beautiful it is as it is. It makes each and every one of us. There's a power that's greater than yourself that one needs to actually put their faith into, and then to let go of all the ego-driven ideology that then drives their addiction and their inability to have the control over their lives that they want to have. So that's how God ended up in the play.
Right.
And because it seemed like God or higher power or supreme being, or, and that's also said in the play, it's like one of the characters says, I don't even know what to call you, God, supreme being, all that ever is and all that ever was, you know, because she doesn't have a name for what her higher power is. But she does start to understand that she does need to give herself over to something if she's going to get her life back to the place that she wants it to be.
So that's part of the recovery and why it's so hard to do it by yourself. I imagine another part is just the community of other people sharing their stories and supporting one another.
Yes, that's very important. Having a sponsor or somebody to help you through this process, because you really can't do it on your own. People have tried to do it on their own, try to do it their own way, and they end up coming back. And it is a process, and we understand that. But letting go of that control is key. Letting go.
One of the things that was interesting in the play, which I just saw the rehearsal of, was rehab romances. People start going through this process, and their hearts open, and the first person who walks by suddenly is their little demigod.
Their soulmate.
Right.
Finally, somebody understands me.
You've seen that.
Many times. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges is encouraging individuals. Now, we use it as a therapeutic opportunity. We wouldn't kick somebody out right away just because we found out they were in a romantic relationship. We try to educate them that there's some uncomfortable stuff coming up for you, and rather than having to deal with those uncomfortable feelings, what a better way than to start coming on to somebody else, flirting with somebody else, your focus can go away again from yourself onto somebody else, and then you don't have to deal with those painful, painful, painful issues.
You are the executive director and clinical director of the Santa Fe Recovery Center. Tell us more about this organization.
Well, it was opened in 2006. A group of concerned citizens got together and took over what was called RAP, Recovering Alcoholics Program, and they hired a new executive director, myself, a new staff, a new board of directors, and it was arising from the ashes. It was heavily in debt. We had to sell the building in order to pay back the debt, a huge debt. I'm happy to say that now we have we own the building. We are also accredited. Every place I had ever worked for was accredited, and this place was not accredited, and so we worked together as a team to accredit it. And being accredited means that it just has to achieve a higher level of professionalism. And what we do is evidence-based, meaning that we just don't kind of throw stuff at the clients thinking, hey, let's give this a whirl. Everything that we do is something that's been tried as a positive model. But we also have yoga and acupuncture and art therapy and music therapy. And I think what I'm most proud of is the staff, very, very compassionate staff. Like I said, I am not in recovery myself, and I'm continuously humbled, continuously, by the process and how compassionate the staff is with mm-hmm. the clients.
Yeah. I would think that some significant percentage of the staff has to be people who have been through this themselves.
Yes, yes. A significant amount of the staff are, and it's balanced, because some of the staff who aren't in recovery can tend to be maybe a little more lenient, and then the ones that are in recovery say,
really?
No, maybe, you know, I think they're putting one on us.
Right,
and
right.
So it's a nice balance of staff, because we can bounce things off of each other, and we don't have one set way of thinking.
So, in other words, the people who have been through this whole process aren't fooled by the charm
fooled.
Of the...
No.
Interesting. So, let's talk about the events that are happening this weekend. God Ain't Done With Me Yet, the play, is going to be performed on Friday and Saturday night at the James A. Little Theater on the campus of the School for the Deaf in Santa Fe. And that's Friday and Saturday at 7 o'clock and Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. But there's also stuff going on the plaza on Saturday.
Yes, on Saturday we're having a day-long event from 10 to 4. The mayor is issuing a proclamation at 10 o'clock proclaiming it Recovery Week. And the governor is sending his representative, Pamela Hyde, at 2 o'clock to also issue a proclamation. So we have a lot of support from the community and from commissioners, Senator Griego, County Commissioner Harry Montoya, Virginia Vigil, I mean, Karen Meter, lots of support and in the work that we're doing, which feels wonderful, because it does take a whole community to address this huge problem.
And, you know, just to let you know, we have like a couple of little cameo guest appearances on the show as well, in the show. On Friday night, Father Murphy from St. Bede's Episcopal Church is going to be doing a walk-on as our special guest. Mayor Koss will be on Saturday night being our special guest. And then Reverend Brendolyn Batchelor from Unity Santa Fe will be our special guest on Sunday.
And so this is all the play God Ain't Done With Me Yet this weekend at the James A. Little Theater, written and directed by Cynthia Ruffin. And Yolanda Brisco is the executive director of the clinical director of the Santa Fe Recovery Center. For more information, people can call 471-4985. And anything else that you guys want to end with?
Please come out and see it.
Well, you know, I do want to end with one thing, and I'm just really impressed at the Santa Fe Recovery Center's ability to be able to see that something like a play can really have the power to affect people in their hearts and to make them more aware of the hard work the Santa Fe Recovery Center is doing in this community, and have something that can function not only as a fundraiser but an awareness builder. So, thank you.
Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. And we are talking during this segment about the Santa Fe Metaphysical Film Festival. I'd like to welcome Carolyn Cabello, who is the director and founder of the Metaphysical Film Festival here in Santa Fe, Sophie Rumanier, and Lexi Chabel, who is the assistant director. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thank you. It's great to be here.
And standing by is Javier Calderon, who is one of the filmmakers. Welcome, Javier.
Now that was an impressive pronunciation. Thank you.
Okay. Now, first of all, Metaphysical Film Festival. What does metaphysical mean?
The dictionary says it means beyond the physical. So that would include supernatural, science fiction, spiritual, cultural ceremonies.
And so these are the kind of things that you have in your films. How do you put together a metaphysical film festival?
Well, it's like putting together any other film festival, as far as I know. But it's specific selections that we're making, which are not really teaching or education. They're more entertainment, but we could call it spiritual entertainment.
So this is, by the way, running this coming weekend, the 18th through the 21st, here in Santa Fe. And Javier Calderon has a film called The God Project. He is the writer, director, editor, lead actor, did just about everything in the film. And it's the story of a man who develops powers of the mind that are psychic and healing. What is the genesis of this story, Javier?
My life. I hesitate to say that because I don't want to, you know, make too much of a brouhaha over the film. But yeah, the honest truth is that the real impetus behind this particular idea came from my own personal experiences. And it is, to a certain extent, autobiographical, but a lot of the influences behind the film just came from personal visions that I've had and ideas that came to me while I was either at work or, you know, here at home working on one particular artistic pursuit or the other. So really just me, my surroundings is where the main influence behind this film came.
So your character is named Joshua, is kind of a, you might call him a brainy math guy, but he has some kind of experience that's transcendent and sort of goes into another realm. How would you describe that other realm that he goes into that's beyond mathematics?
It's interesting that you initiate that description of Joshua as being a brainy math guy because, yes, he is that. But as will hopefully be seen throughout the course of viewing the film, there's definitely much more to Joshua behind the intellectual aspect of his character. And so he goes into this, I guess, using an appropriate word, metaphysical state through you know, a lot of meditation that he goes through, and he's basically a searcher, and so he's going through this journey of sorts, and in the process of going through that journey, he does a lot of research, and that research, among other things, begins opening him up spiritually, metaphysically, psychologically, in a bunch of different ways, and that research itself allows him to begin to become more receptive to what at least the film postulates is an overall kind of ethereal existence of divinity that exists right before our very eyes. So he's kind of just tapping into what is already there for everyone to tap into. But it comes to him a little bit more receptively because of the studies and the research that he is undergoing throughout the course of the film.
Now, is this a kind of research that is really happening somewhere, or did you kind of make it up as a fiction for this film?
Well, I have a degree in philosophy, so my own readings really tend to favor that kind of study. And in a lot of the readings and research that I've been doing, I've come across some really, really interesting, to put it quite mildly, perspectives and viewpoints as far as the world that we live in and the space that we occupy in that world. And to put it, I guess shortly to you, a lot of what Joshua is going through is indeed actually a quite mild form of expansion that a lot of historical individuals themselves have actually documentedly gone through. So as quote-unquote out there, as a lot of the experiences that the character Joshua goes through in the film, as out there as they may seem, they are actually kind of accurate representations of what certain historical figures have actually themselves documented in their own writings.
How would you describe what some of these historical figures have gone through? Who are you talking about?
I'm talking about people that we ourselves are pretty familiar with, like characters like Jesus Christ, Krishna, Buddha, and I would describe a lot of their experience. Well, let me say this. It is a little bit difficult, of course, the undertaking which I had in this project, and for that matter will continue to have in future projects because I plan to continue this kind of vein of filmmaking. But it's a little bit difficult because a lot of their experiences and the description of their experiences is understandably abstract, because what they're experiencing is such as occurs on a level of existence beyond the quote-unquote regular third-dimensional existence that we presently live on. And so the words that they use of their own admittance are very vague and inadequate representations of what is actually happening to them while they're having these experiences. And I decided to attempt to represent some of these experiences that they had, and for that matter that I myself have had, in the visual medium. So how would I describe it? It's really tough because I'm trying to put a very concrete visual stamp on an experience which is ultimately not just personal, but really quite difficult to relate to another human being. You have to actually experience it on your own in order to understand it.
How did you use your camera work and editing and post-production to kind of give people a sense of this experience? It seems like that's very much part of the experience of watching the film, is your style of filmmaking.
Let me say this. I am certainly very influenced filmatically by styles related to people like Darren Aronofsky, Peter Berg, who has a pretty substantial acting background, but as a director, he's done stuff that's pretty impressive. Paul Greengrass is another director, the director who's done the Bourne Identity on films, and also did United 93. This type of filmmaking is definitely an acquired taste, but it's a very kind of free, handheld, I almost call it metaphorical filmmaking, because what it is, it gets from point A to point B in a visual manner that doesn't necessarily hold your hand through what they're attempting to represent, but instead you understand something happened from the moment that you began the scene to the moment where you ended the scene, and you kind of got the feeling of what actually occurred, but you're not exactly sure exactly how it happened because there's so many cuts. There is so much, again, I don't want to overuse the word, but abstraction involved in that representation. So how did I come to this particular approach to this style of filmmaking? Well, I would say two things. One, it came from the some of the influences which I mentioned, and, you know, and I just gravitate to that kind of style and feel. And also, to be quite honest, there is also the just straight economic aspect involved during the making of this film, of the fact that because it was shot on a budget, and because of the fact that there weren't huge crews, and because of the fact that there weren't huge Hollywood cranes that could smoothly glide the camera up or down or in any direction that you want, there was an inherent level of shakiness and unsteadiness. And instead of attempting to hide that, I embraced that aspect of the camera's quote-unquote deficiencies and made that work as an artistic choice.
There is a moment where I thought it was a really interesting representation of your life flashing before you in what is perhaps the last moment of one's life. How did you think about that?
Are you referring to the last moments of the actual movie itself?
There's a couple of moments where there's edits that look like one frame each.
And I'm like, okay, what moment was that? Because there were so many different flashes and strange things happening that I'm like, okay, what part are you referring to, Mary?
Well, the part. Well, I don't want to ruin the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
For,
don't
for
give
people,
it away.
But in any case, Carolyn Cabello wants to comment. Also, go ahead.
Oh yes, I wanted to say that I think what Javier's talking about is what could be called Christ consciousness, as some people call it that. And I think, and part of the main reason for this film festival is that I feel that we all have this ability, we all have this capacity to become spiritually alive and spiritually conscious and to live our lives that way. And at the moment of death, all that will come to pass. So that's what the festival is all about.
Javier Calderon, what are you working on now? This project is finished. Are you going to continue to make films?
Oh, absolutely. I, for better or for worse, sometimes I feel for worse, I have no choice. I'm an artist. And so I am presently working on the script to the next film that will begin production this year, coming up, and I plan to be finished with that one, you know, in as short a time as possible. But that particular film coming up will also be another tour de force in I guess, you know, the kind of filmmaking which really forces me to delve into it 100% and give of myself just as much as I did for the God Project, and so I'm really looking forward to working on the next film as well, because there are going to be many aspects that will involve risk, not just emotionally but physically as well. So the next film should begin production a few months, hopefully.
And you will be here in Santa Fe attending the Santa Fe Metaphysical Film Festival, and you will be on a panel discussion on Saturday at 4:45 in the afternoon.
Spirit and
We're
film.
Looking forward to seeing you.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to seeing everyone, and thank you for having me, Mary.
It's a great pleasure. The film is called The God Project. It's part of the Santa Fe Metaphysical Film Festival, and we are here with Carolyn Cabello and Lexi Chabel and Sophie Rumanier. So how did each of you get interested in metaphysical topics and metaphysical films in particular? Lexi, we've had you on the air doing something which was distinctly unmetaphysical, which was a documentary about a rock and roll band.
Isn't that metaphysical?
Well, I know when I said that, I thought maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's the philosophical interpretation of metaphysics, is that it can encompass anything in a philosophy. I mean, their philosophy could be considered nihilistic or fatalistic or living in the moment. They could be the ultimate Buddhist, the ultimate Zen Buddhist, the Unbanned is a rock and roll band.
You think?
Yeah. Not really. I think probably. I've come on to this festival, and I've had the pleasure of working on it for actually just less than a month, and it's been really inspirational to work with Carolyn and Sophie, who are a mother and daughter team, and that's really exciting to see two people be able to make a project happen who are related. And I think a lot of my experience just in terms of being a filmmaker and going around showing films and working on film festivals is what I offer this festival.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been doing, I guess, metaphysical work since the 70s. And I started out as a therapist and then became a channel and a spiritual guide and a teacher. And then I went into writing books and designing games. And now I'm a
games?
A spiritual game.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
It's called Avalon, Temple of Connection, and it's something that we're going to sell it at the festival so everyone can come see it. It's a spiritual journey. It's non-competitive game. So it's actually, I don't know if game is the right word, but it works with sound and color, and it's it affects the DNA. It helps you become more spiritually conscious.
We should set that up in the art market, and that could be like the whole Avalon tournament.
Oh.
We're taking over the ballroom of the Scottish Rite Temple, which is such a beautiful space, and we're having an art market and fair with like healers and food vendors and metaphysicians and definitely a place to hang and talk to people about consciousness. And I think that this game, yes, I see a grand tourney going on.
It's been done.
A grand tourney of a non-competitive game.
Yes, we have had over 50 people do it at one time once.
Now, I have to just say, when I think of a room full of metaphysicians, my BS detectors go off. How do you screen? I mean, how do you, you know, make sure? I mean, there's so many people who are full of baloney who are saying stuff in this world.
That's true. I guess from the highest point of view, it's self-selected. The people who are drawn to it are going to be there and present their art, and we carefully selected the films from a metaphysical point of view, which is a little different from a spiritual point of view, but it encompasses spirituality. And I've been living with the, you know, kind of being a weirdo or a woo-woo person, but I don't look and act like one, for all my career, all my life, so, you know, it's not new.
Her daughter is laughing. Do you disagree?
No, I agree. I just was entertained by the descriptive words. I grew up in a metaphysical household, you know, whether I liked it or not. So I was exposed to all kinds of trippy, woo-woo, wild, you know, BS people or wild, trippy, transcendental, you know, interesting, amazing experiences. So, I mean, I'm a filmmaker, but I'm not a metaphysical filmmaker.
What are your films about?
I'm a documentary filmmaker. I talk about social issues. So in a way, that's metaphysical. You know, we're sort of helping people, like Lexi was saying, think about things in a different way. So, you know, but I'm really just enjoying being a part of bringing people together and being part of a community event is really important to me. And I think that it'll be really interesting to see how many wild people come out of the woodworks to come and share this weekend with us.
It seems like when I moved to Santa Fe in the 90s, there was a lot more going on. There were stores like the Galactic Chalice and just a lot more sort of crystal healing things than there are now. What's happened?
I think it's going mainstream. That actually this, what used to be called so weird, is actually reaching down into people's minds and hearts. And so it's not so unusual, maybe.
I find it interesting that Carolyn is flanked by her daughter, who had a mohawk for 5 years and was known as the punk reigning queen of Thailand, owning a punk bar, and like, I have a rock and roll thing and have just cut my head into a mohawk. And it's like, for some reason, we're, you know, I think we also do represent a metaphysical consciousness. It's this idea of You know, what do you do to make your life and other people's lives mean something?
Yes, I highly agree. Well put. Yeah.
So this is all happening this weekend, and we've been trying to get Eduardo Arguelles on the phone, who's made a wonderful short film called A Dream Tonal, but he seems not to be answering his telephone.
He's very busy today.
Oh, well, ladies and gentlemen.
Getting ready to come over.
But it's actually an interesting film. It's a short, but it deals with, you know, brujería, witchcraft in Mexico. How did you find that film?
I found it very interesting, and I thought the way that it was filmed was presented the idea, that the actual cinematography, the directing, the editing, all takes you into another state. It's descriptive, but it's also transcendental, I guess you could say, or
in the sense that the viewer kind of
goes on a little trip, you know, with the person.
It's being shown with the other mind-altering shorts that will be a section in the film festival, so you can have a transcendental psychedelic experience by watching this film.
And in absolutely legal manner.
Yeah.
So,
footnote about Eduardo Arguelles is that he and I almost 10 years ago worked on Road Rules and lived on a ship with 600 college students shooting for a reality show.
Really?
Yes.
Considering that we're now saying that everything on the planet is metaphysical, tell us a little bit about that experience.
Incredibly metaphysical in that one had to have constant discipline and rules because none of the MTV crew was supposed to touch any of the college students. So, you know, I guess that's a lesson in discipline and responsibility. Reality TV, any kind of documentary, I mean, it all has different parameters regarding what the wall up is. What are your what is your ethics in terms of getting close to your subjects, or do you, with reality shows, you're supposed to always have a wall up. You're not supposed to develop a relationship, which my own theory of documentary is, how can you get somebody to trust you unless you develop a relationship with them? So I'm not sure what that has to do with metaphysics.
The Metaphysical Film Festival is this weekend, ladies and gentlemen, in New Mexico at the 18th through the 21st at the Scottish Rite Temple in Santa Fe. Now, is that a good venue for? I've never seen a film there.
It's a great venue. It's the best we have in Santa Fe, I think.
Because, really?
Yeah.
Well, it's for the Freemasons. You know, it's their building, and so they have a long spiritual tradition from the Knights Templar. The building inside has beautiful Tiffany chandeliers and stained glass windows and lights that make constellations of the stars on the ceiling and beautiful curtains, and it's just gorgeous.
It really is a fabulous location. I mean, that was what got me excited once I came on board, was we did a walkthrough, and we're just going to dominate the whole building. And there's all these cool little nooks and crannies. And we have the ballroom upstairs, which is going to, as I said, have the art market and fair and a place to commune. But also our gala, which is going to have our MC from the awards ceremony, which is at 8 o'clock on Saturday, Gary Farmer, local hero, and his band, The Troublemakers, will be playing the gala upstairs. Just a gorgeous room with chandeliers, and they've just redone the floors. And we'll also have a Balinese gong parade starting off the whole gala, as well as firelight dancers. And the whole festival, you know, really to Sophie and Carolyn's credit, is filled with all of those little surprises, as well as attending filmmakers. After a film at 7:15 on Friday, the sound you feel, there's going to be a singing bowl performance by the director. I mean, there's just a lot of those little nuances and a lot of attending filmmakers. And as, you know, said, God Project is a world premiere. We've been very fortunate as a first-year festival to have several world premieres and also some great keynote speakers and panels that they'll be on.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about the speakers. The keynote speakers are Bonnie Dorr and Kevin Ryerson. And Bonnie Dorr is a LA TV producer. She's also the former president of Women in Film and Television International. So she's actually very supportive and a pioneer in women in film, which is very important given how the film industry has been. And Kevin Ryerson is an intuitive psychic. Counselor. He's worked on a number of films with filmmakers, supporting them and counseling them as far as from the spiritual point of view and from the psychic intuitive point of view. He's also helped me. And another woman that's coming, Kathy Rozek, has also been intimately involved in the creation of the film festival as an advisor to me. She's also an intuitive. So we have multidimensional experiences to offer you.
And so this is all happening this weekend. And if people want more information, they can call 820-6030. Anything else? Is that not correct?
Another phone number, 924.
No, 984-0272.
984-0272.
That's the best number.
Is the best number.
As well as going to the website at metaphysicalfilm.com, and that's got your entire schedule. We have some great parties also happening. I mean, we have like an East Indian party that's we're having a live Hindu chant band with Sita and the Shiva Brothers, and then East Indian trance music with DJ Spinifex on Friday at the Hotel Plaza Real. And what's really cool is we're keeping the prices way rock bottom, so the whole public can come. I mean, that's at the Hotel Plaza Real. It's $5. The gala is only $10, and you know you can buy a pass, and that's not that much either. So we really want everybody to be part of it and feel like this is a community event.
Carolyn Cabello is the director and founder. Sophie Rumanier is administrative director and co-founder. And Lexi Chabel is assistant director of the Santa Fe Metaphysical Film Festival. Thank you, ladies, so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao. Thank you.